Good evening and welcome to Representative Ross Hunter's live telephone town hall. My name is Lilia and I'll be moderating tonight's call. Thanks for taking the time to join us. We hope you'll find this call informative. In a moment, I'll turn the phone over to State Representative Ross Hunter for some opening remarks, but first I want to explain the format for tonight's call. If you would like to ask a question, just press star 3 on your phone and you'll be connected with a staff person who'll take your question and get you into the queue to speak directly with Representative Hunter. Please note that this is a live question and answer session. By pressing star 3 on your phone right now, you'll have an opportunity to speak directly with Representative Hunter. We want to get through as many of your questions as possible during this call, so we have to limit participants to only one question each. Pressing star 3 right now is all you need to do to ask your question. Here's some information on your legislator. Representative Ross Hunter represents the 48th Legislative District, which includes parts of Redmond, Kirkland, and Bellevue, and all of Clyde Hill, Hunts Point, Yarrow Point, and Medina. He was first elected to the House in 2002. Representative Hunter earned his Bachelor's in Computer Science from Yale University and worked at Microsoft for 17 years. He chairs the House Appropriations Committee, the Washington State Economic and Revenue Forecast Council, and serves on two tax and commerce-related committees for the National Conference of State Legislatures. His main interests in the legislature are education funding, tax system fairness, and transportation infrastructure. Remember, press star 3 on your phone right now to ask a question. And now, here is Representative Ross Hunter with opening remarks.
Gosh, it's nice to have you all there, even though I can't see you. I don't know how many times I've given those basically those same opening remarks for myself. It's sort of nice to have someone else do it. So I wanted to do an intro and do a brief précis of what we did in the legislature this year and then bring it back to what I thought was our agenda for the year. My job is to negotiate a budget. This is what we call a supplemental year. It's a short session, and typically we make small fixes to the budget, and that's what we did this year. We were able to come to a bipartisan agreement on a balanced budget, a budget that's balanced both in the current time period and out into the future. It's balanced over the four-year budget period. To give you some context on how difficult this is, the federal government hasn't had a balanced budget since the Clinton administration. So we actually do that work and get that work done, and I was able to negotiate with the Republican majority in the Senate, and we've come to a what I described in the press as a modest budget. I think it doesn't address a number of things that we ought to be addressing. It does not address our McCleary obligation. We were unable to get traction in the Senate to take a step, a big step, as the court wanted us to do. We did add about $60 million, which sounds like a lot of money, but is not in the context of a $15 billion education budget. We did one thing that I'm very pleased about, though, which is we made an increase in our mental health infrastructure, which is the number of psychiatric beds that we have available for really horrendous cases. The case that was in the press a lot this year was the Reuter case, a young man who lived in a condominium in Seattle, had a job. I think he worked at Amazon or somewhere like that, and he had a psychotic break, and his family could not get to the judge to get him committed, which he needed to be, and eventually he started shooting at the police out of his fifth-floor window, and the police don't have a lot of options at that point, and we now have one fewer young man who, with an appropriate intervention, we'd still have as a productive member of society. We've tried to increase our capacity there, and that's a place where we did agree with the Senate and came to a place where we've added a fairly large number of new beds, 48 new psychiatric beds around the state, and a number of other teams that do in-place interventions. I'm excited about that. It's one of the few things in the budget that I'm particularly excited about, other than that we came to an agreement and got it done and fixed all the sort of fundamental problems that we have to deal with. The things that I'm unhappy about that I said we needed to do at the beginning of the year was we needed to do a transportation package. We were unable to come to an agreement on the Senate with that, and I'm concerned that we could lose traction on finishing the rest of the 520 bridge, and I really do not want to live with a half-finished bridge for the next decade. for the first time in 20 years, we were unable to come to an agreement with the Senate on a capital budget. So that's the money we used to build schools, to fix broken culverts all over the state, and we were unable to come to an agreement on there. And I'm also concerned that we did not make what was a relatively small fix in how we do teacher and principal evaluations that will result in us losing control over about $40 million a year in money that goes to schools with high populations of low-income children. Now, that's not Bellevue and Lake Washington, the two school districts that I represent, but it is Seattle. Seattle loses millions of dollars. Tacoma loses millions of dollars. Yakima loses millions of dollars. And I'm concerned about that. That's money that goes directly towards programs for our most at-risk kids. So this was a short session. I'm disappointed in the amount of work that we got done. There are some bright spots, and hopefully they'll come up as we do questions, or I'll intervene and sort of stick some stuff in if people have questions about that. So with that, we'll go to questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Folks, if you're just joining us, this is a live telephone town hall with your State Representative Ross Hunter for the 48th Legislative District. If you have a question for him, please press star 3 on your keypad right now. And we're going with our first caller, and this is Mark from Kirkland. Mark has a question about transportation. Mark?
I do. Okay. Thank you, Representative Hunter, for taking my call. And you alluded to it already a little bit, but my question is about that transportation funding. Specifically King County Metro Transit. I take the bus into work every day from Kirkland to Seattle, and that route is on the chopping block along with, two-thirds of all routes are going to be affected. They're going to have to cut service by 17%. I mean, this is a huge problem, and I know you couldn't reach consensus, but what is the plan for coming to consensus, especially in a climate where we're trying to encourage mass transit use to reduce our traffic congestion problems? It's one of the main reasons why we bought a house in Kirkland was the ease of transportation to get downtown, and I'm severely concerned about it.
Well, we in the House share your concern. The Central Puget Sound is very concerned about transit infrastructure. This 17% cut affects the east side very dramatically. And, you know, you have a specific knowledge about your route, but there are a lot of routes that are eliminated. There are routes that are cut back. And I worry that they're cut back to the point there, if it's not reliable for you to get home from work, you then drive, and then we're back to having this if 30,000 people, which I think is the number that turns into regular commuters, start driving again, we're back to a crazy disaster in traffic congestion, which we already have, and we don't want to make worse. We're one of the sort of five worst metro areas in the country for congestion already. So we think that's really important in the House. The Democrats in the House thought that was really important, and a much more flexible package that King County was much more excited about than the current legislation that they're putting forward would have been. The Senate, the chair of the Transportation Committee, is a very nice man who lives in Yakima, and they have a very different perspective. He actually doesn't really like transit that much, and doesn't really think so that was one of the places where we were not able to come to consensus, is how do we let King County do what it needs to do. They were proposing, we're all sort of proposing about a 10-year building package to fix highway problems, some of which are important for actually getting transit back and forth, like the 520 bridge, but making that be the centerpiece of what you do doesn't make sense to those guys. And that's one of the places where we're stuck, and we're going to have to work on coming to an agreement around that. I really think the problem is that the Senate doesn't really have the votes, or the Senate Republican Caucus does not have the votes to pass the transportation package. We passed one last year. It's not one I'm super excited about, but it's a transportation package and would have addressed King County's problems. The would have addressed their short-term problem. it doesn't give King County 10 years of headroom on transit, which I think we ought to do in transportation package. But so we're going to be back at the table. We will see how the King County ballot measure turns out next month. Ballots should be out pretty soon for that. And if that passes, it changes the equation pretty significantly in terms of what a package that, if it were to go on the ballot, would need to look like in order to pass statewide. Because in order to pass, it's got to get 65% in Seattle and in the central east side. Because if it doesn't, it won't pass. And so at that point, you start negotiating about Sound Transit 3 or the next. You might actually get the next thing on transit. But this is one thing I'm very frustrated about.
All right. Thank you. And, folks, you are live with Representative Ross Hunter from the 48th District. If you have a question, please press star 3 on your keypad right now to get your question in the queue. We're going now with Nancy, who has a question about funding for the homeless. Nancy?
What happened to the, at the final, at the end, to the, what was inadequate, but the homeless appropriation that was on a transaction fee, as I recall?
In the last couple of hours, the question is about a fee that we charge for documents that are recorded with the court. And the vast bulk of these documents wind up being sort of mortgage documents or documents about housing transactions. And the fee was set to expire this year, and we had just this immense fight. The Seattle Times called it legislative malpractice for the Senate to not adopt the bill. The chair of the committee over there chose to not move the bill forward, even though it was clear that we had the votes in committee to do that. And I guess at the very end, she had an epiphany and introduced a new bill that she was the prime sponsor of, so she gets credit for passing the bill. And the bill was one of the last bills that passed in the last hours of the session. So we have a five-year extension on the document recording fee that sort of gets us through the next couple of legislative sessions, and then we can figure out how to make that a permanent part of the revenue structure for our low-income housing efforts. So it did pass, but it was really one of the last two or three bills that passed.
Okay, thank you. Folks, we are just starting with this call with Representative Ross Hunter from the 48th. If you have a question, please press star 3 on your keypad right now. We're going with Patricia now, who has a question about foster kids. Patricia?
Hello, Representative. I understood there was a bill proposed to extend care funding for foster kids beyond the age 18, and I wondered what happened to it, where it went.
Well, okay, so the question is about what we call foster care to 21. And right now, our system provides kids with foster care until they're 18. Now, my kids just passed through that period of 18 to 21 phase. And I know that if I had dropped my kid off in downtown Seattle at 18, either of them, we would have had a disaster. And that is actually typically what does happen with our foster kids. About 3% of them wind up graduating from college. We have a very low graduation rate from high school. And one of the problems is that they turn 18 and they become homeless. And so over the last couple of years, we've done an extension that is tied to behavior. So kids that are engaged in productive activities, if they're going to school, there's like five different categories. And the category that we added this year, we've done three of the five categories. The category that we added this year was for kids who are working more than 80 hours a month. So they have more than half-time employment. Many of those kids are also trying to go to school, but they're not quite going to school full-time. And if they're engaged in that sort of productive activity, we'll allow them to stay in the foster care system through age 21, which gives them an ability to sort of ramp into the real world. This was a bill that we did pass this year, and I'm real excited about passing the policy. it was funded in both budgets, and we're able to make that happen. So this is something that we agreed with the Republicans on. It's an important improvement in how we care for children that are in our care system.
Thank you. We have a lot of people on this call, so we're going to ask you to please be patient, but we do want to get your questions. So please press *3 on your keypad right now if you have a question for Representative Ross Hunter. We're going with Steve, who has a question about teacher COLAs. Steve?
Hi, my name is Steve. I live in Bellevue, Representative Hunter. Mm-hmm. My son is a teacher for Vashon High School and has not had a pay increase for many years. Mm-hmm. What is the plan for giving them a living wage and pay increases to keep up with inflation?
Well, this was one of the places where we disagreed with the Republicans in the Senate. The House passed a bill that the House actually put it in the budget, was doing a COLA this year. You don't actually have to pass a bill to do the COLA this year. We put $53 million in our budget to give a COLA to both teachers and there are other educators, other people who do aides and other work who would also get a COLA through that. And it was in our budget until the last minute. The Senate refused to negotiate on the issue. And in the end, this is a budget that only has things that both the House and the Senate agreed to. So if either of us disagreed, it came out. And this was one they absolutely refused to negotiate over. They refused to do it. So we didn't do it this year. Initiative 732 sort of snaps back into law next year. And so we will do a COLA for teachers next year. Many districts in the central Puget Sound, and I don't know Vashon off the top of my head, but our districts certainly have given raises paid for by local property taxpayers. And my big concern here, one, is that by not giving COLAs to teachers who live in districts where they don't have the ability to tax their local property to get it, they've lost about 16% of their buying power. Places like Bellevue have given cost of living increases, and what the court's telling us, the Supreme Court is telling us, is that that is unconstitutional, that is an unconstitutional shift of the state's responsibility to pay for teacher salaries to local school districts, which means then that local taxpayers have to pay for it. Again, this winds out working out reasonably well for Bellevue, but it does not work out well for Yakima. It does not work out well for Tukwila, for the places where we have the most at-risk kids. And so we wind up with teachers who are losing ground and kids in districts that have a lot of poverty not being able to hire the best teachers because they don't pay as much. And this is just crazy. So I'm really frustrated about it. It was one thing as we were going through the depths of the worst recession since the Great Depression, but we're done with this now. And I wanted to fund it this year. The Senate refused to do that. I'm done voting for deferring it. So we will absolutely do that next year.
Thank you very much, folks. If you are just joining us, this is your telephone town hall with Representative Ross Hunter from the 48th Legislative District. If you have a question, please press *3 on your keypad right now. We're now going with Gail, who has a question about Joel's Law, 2725. Gail?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Representative Hunter. I am interested in Joel's Law and was following your role, I believe, in that and appreciated it. I would like you to explain why you think that died in the Senate.
Okay.
And how to get it through next time.
Okay. So for those people who don't know what Joel's Law is, the example I gave a little earlier in the call, there was a young man in his early 20s, lives in a condominium. In fact, he lived on the fifth floor of the condominium in Seattle. And I know what the condominium looks like, and this is a sort of a personal connection, because my son was his next-door neighbor. The man had a psychotic break, some kind of I am not a psychiatrist, and I don't play one on TV, so I don't know what to call his particular problem, but I understand he thought he was shooting at zombies. Out of his window at 4 o'clock in the morning, he's shooting at police officers, and they do what they have to do in that scenario and shot back. And Joel's law was a law that would have allowed his parents, who knew what the problem was, to intervene, to speak to the judge who is in charge of having him committed or not. And the House passed this law, and the Senate did not. And you'd have to ask Senator Andy Hill, who's my counterpart in the Senate, why he didn't pass it. My guess is that we're all concerned about what does it cost. And I, as a budget chairman, I wind up having a very odd perspective on public policy. And sometimes you look at something and say, that is absolutely the right thing to do, but oh my goodness, it costs $1 billion and I don't have $1 billion. Or it costs some large amount of money and we don't quite know how much it's going to cost. And this is one of those cases. We don't know how much it would, how many more people would have involuntary treatment if we allowed parents to intervene with the judge. I was willing to take the risk. The Senate was not. And so the bill died in the Senate. We are doing some studies to try and estimate how much this would actually cost. And that may be enough for the Senate, but the real answer of how do you get something done is you either convince the people who are in power in the Senate that this is something that absolutely has to happen, and I think it's unconscionable that we don't allow this. And I had a number of personal conversations with the young man's parents, and they can't talk to the judge. They're the families of the people who know what goes on here. We need to allow the parents to talk to them, and we may need to have more psychiatric beds. In fact, I know we do because we're 49th in the country in community psychiatric beds. So we have to do that anyway. So you pressure the Senate. So you speak to Senator Tom, who has some leverage in the Republican caucus in the Senate. You speak to Senator Hill from the 45th, which is the district just north of mine. If we did our calls right, none of you are from the 45th. And if that doesn't work, if you can't get them to agree that they're going to do that, then you have to decide to change the makeup of the Senate. That's not a conversation I can do on this call, but you should pressure the Senate, because I think this is something that it's unconscionable for us not to do. I have a note that was just handed me where I'm supposed to say now that you should hit *3 to get your question in the queue. And I've done a couple of these calls, and we never get to all the questions. So when we're done, we will ask you to leave your question in a message, and I will call you back with an answer, and I will try and write down the answers to all the questions that came in, and I will post them on my website at rosshunter.info so that people can get. So I'll try and answer all the questions. I mean, if there's 400, I won't, but typically there are about 20, and I will try and get to all of those. So *3 to get your question in the queue.
All right, thank you. And folks, if you are just joining us, this is a live telephone town hall with Representative Ross Hunter from the 48th District. If you have a question, please press *3 now to get it in the queue. We're going with Chuck, who has a question about tax reform. Chuck?
Thanks for taking my call and my question. I'm having a real hard time with tax cuts for these huge corporations. Nothing against them. Everybody needs to make money, but we just recently gave Boeing about, what, $10 billion. And then they go around and they turn around and get, well, it was eight, you know, but what, it's probably got two more billion off the last tax break that we gave them. And then they get refunds from the federal taxes, and aren't they great? And everybody is happy when they give us a little bit of our money back because they help the community a little bit. But it's our money. So it's like we're made to suffer here. So is there any way we can, like, reopen negotiations? Boeing would really appreciate that. They see the value in that. And maybe take a five-year moratorium and nobody gets any more tax breaks for 5 years till we get our financial house in order. And then, and if we're not going to collect these taxes, then just get rid of them. And one thing on the pensions, since we're cutting pensions, let's get rid of all the pensions for the legislature. Nothing personal, you understand, but if everybody's going to suffer, let's make everybody suffer.
All right, so two questions there, tax reform and pensions. And I'll start with the tax reform. So this year was the first year of in a long time where there have not been a tax decrease. We had a sort of a very minor net increase in taxes. We repealed a tax exemption for people who grow marijuana. We repealed all of the tax exemptions that would apply to them if we called them farmers. Farmers essentially don't pay taxes on their business. And we decided that people who are growing marijuana are not farmers. They're people who grow marijuana. So that raises about $5 million. And then there were a couple of other little adjustments that happened in there that are less than that. This is the first time when that's been true in a very long time. And there's some things that we need to talk about. The Boeing issue came up last fall. The governor called a special session with a day and a half's notice. So Tuesday afternoon, I was in my office and watched his press conference where he called us in on Thursday to pass a bill that hadn't been written yet. Representative Carlisle and I rewrote that bill to add all of the accountability that was in the bill. What it did was take Boeing's current taxes, their current tax model, how much do they pay today, what their current ratio is, and say, and that goes from now until 2024 when it expires. And we said, all right, if they agree to build the 777X here in Washington, we will keep them with their current tax rates from 2024 to 2040. And that has turned out to be the case. They are building the 777X here, which saves, I don't know, 20,000 jobs here in Washington. It's about 8%, 4 to 6% of the state's economy is directly a result of Boeing here. I'm kind of over a barrel in this situation. The governor presents the bill. The bill's going to pass. We were able to add the accountability that says that they not only do they have to build the plane here to get it, but they also can't build the plane anywhere else. So they can't do what happened to us in 2003 when we thought we had a deal on the 787, except then they opened the North Carolina line, or the South Carolina line, wherever that is, Charleston. I don't know if I'm as frustrated as you are. I'm pretty frustrated about that one. But we have to deal with the McCleary situation, and I don't see us giving tax breaks in the near future. And the Senate introduced this year about 24 new tax breaks that totaled about $250 million over the next 4 years. I will point out they introduced more tax breaks than they proposed adding to the K-12 budget, and that does not seem like the right direction for us to go. So we did not do that. We had proposed some tax increases. We proposed eliminating some loopholes. The Senate was unwilling to do that as well. So in a supplemental year, we sort of stared at each other. Next year, we will have to fund about $2.2 billion of increase for McCleary, and that will be hard to do. So there's your sort of it's an existential thing on tax reform. We need to fix the tax system. I think this next step on McCleary will expose that problem in a very deep way, and I am having some back-channel negotiations with some of the key Republicans about, well, where are we going to go on this, and is there something better than either the property tax solution that I have proposed or the other obvious solution would be a penny increase in the sales tax, which is sort of profoundly unattractive as a very regressive tax move, one that hurts low-income people. So we're having those discussions. We have not come to a conclusion yet. your question on pensions was, if we're going to eliminate pensions for state employees, can we eliminate pensions for state legislators? And the answer is the same for both of them. One is we're not eliminating pensions for state employees. In fact, the pensions for state employees are guaranteed by the Constitution moving forward, and legislators are state employees. We could change pensions for new employees if we wanted to do that. We have no interest in doing that. Our pension system is not all that expensive. It costs us about 4.5% of salary to fund the pension system adequately for current benefits. We are paying to catch up to an old benefit system that was created in 1977 or was ended in 1977. And they used what I will call a now and later approach to paying for it, which was they cut it off then and said, we'll pay for it later. And now is the later for the guys in the late 70s. So they fixed the problem. We have to pay for it. I was still in high school in 1977. And so that's a frustrating thing for me, is that we're paying for benefits in many cases for people who have long since retired. And one of the key tenets of pension policy is you have to understand the actuarial cost of the pension promises you make, and you actually have to pay for it at the time the worker does the work. And since I have been a key player on the budget, we have done that. We are now one of the five best states in the country for being responsible in funding our pension system. It's not, our pensions are not as extravagant as, say, California pensions, but that's because our taxes are not as extravagant as California is either. The pensions for state legislators are, when I describe the budget as modest, the pensions are even more modest. That we're in the same boat as every other state employee. I don't think we're likely to eliminate pensions for state employees because we would lose in court. That there's very clear Supreme Court precedent on that, that we can't do that. So, again, if people have questions, they can hit *3 to get questions in the queue, and we'll go to the next question.
Thank you. And, yes, sure enough, please press *3 on your keypad if you have a question. We're going now with Neil, who has a question about energy policy. Neil? Hello? Neil? Neil from Kirkland?
Hello. Hello, hi. Representative Hunter. Oh, hi. Thank you so much for the town hall tonight. And Representative Hunter, I've heard some of your communications via email about your, you know, your thoughts on McCleary or the Boeing deal. So it's really good, Chuck's questions and your responses. I don't think pensions are the thing that's redistributing wealth in our economy right now. But when we look at some of the things in our economy that really do say where our money goes, one of the chief ones seems to be our energy policy. And I realize we can't at a state level set a national energy policy, but I do want to ask you, what can we do on the state level? I mean, you're in the budget committee, and some of the things that other states are, say, let's look at, you know, whatever you may think of Germany's efforts with solar energy. They've got a huge amount of rooftop collectors. They've got many different kinds of alternative energy coming online. Not just Germany, many other countries around the world are really investing in their infrastructure, and they're making it so individuals like me or just, you know, renters, homeowners, whatever you say, they can invest in their own energy production systems and sort of decouple from the grid that's just going to be a future of delivering power through their chains, you know, through dirty coal. You know, I'm really concerned about the prospect of coal trains just changing the face of Washington forever. Not just coal trains, but this entire dirty energy economy it's doing several things. It's taking all the money that we're paying to these, you know, large energy companies and concentrating the wealth into their hands. And, you know, they turn around and they send their money, you know, into tax shelters, sort of like what Microsoft and Boeing and Google like to do. But I know there are things that we can do on a state level. And I'm wondering, what do you think some of the things that we could do to either give tax credits for homeowners so they can invest in something on the rooftop, or energy management systems so that we can do, you know, so we can really cut down our use of individual energy consumption, and also to build an infrastructure that is ours, that is our state. It's not owned by Puget Sound Energy. It's not owned by Massey Coal. It's not dependent upon, you know, a drilling company that's going to take their, you know, their drilling box and slam it into the, you know, the Skagit River Bridge. I'm sorry. There's a lot of problems that come from dirty energy, and unless we do something, we're going to be stuck at 2030 with this dirty energy black hole where everybody's stuck on coal, everybody's, you know, paying, you know, $10 a gallon for gas, and the energy money keeps going to the energy producers, and we're stuck. Okay. And thank you.
Let me try and address some of those issues. So I think there's a couple of things that you want to talk about when you talk about energy policy. One of the things that we're trying to accomplish there is to have a more renewable energy policy. So you start with the basis of Initiative 937, which passed everywhere, passed overwhelmingly in the 48th, to require all of our utilities to move to a larger fraction of their portfolio of where they get their energy from coming from renewable sources. Every year there are a set of bills that are introduced. It's a bipartisan effort. It's done by people who live in districts where their utility ignored the initiative and now has to buy renewable power late, and it's more expensive. And so they get all wired up. Pierce County gets wired up about this. That's sort of interesting. But the bills never pass. So there were a bunch of bills that were passed this year to try and roll back 937. Those didn't pass. They haven't passed every year that I've been in the legislature. So I don't think they're going to pass. So there's the first step, is to not go backwards on that. The next step is to look at the sort of big things that you can do. The first big thing that you can do is deal with TransAlta, which is the coal plant in Centralia, and how we get out of that. And Governor Gregoire, cut a deal with them that's a transition plan for them coming off of coal and presumably moving to natural gas or some other less damaging form of power generation. And it's a messy process, and it always makes me crazy, partly because I'm not in the room, but it just requires money to sort of fix that problem. We're working on trying to close that thing down, reduce the power consumption from coal in-state. The next thing that you do is you say, all right, we in-state are buying a bunch of power, and I think it's about 25% of PSE's portfolio is generated in with coal plants in Montana. And we can force PSE to not buy that power. Now, the renewable power will be a little bit more expensive, but we can say we're not buying this coal power, which will reduce the demand for the coal power generation, which changes the economics of it. The economics of the coal trains have changed pretty significantly. We are unlikely to have a coal terminal in Bellingham because they had a county council election up there, and all of the anti-coal train people won despite massive infusions of money, and I think they're unlikely to permit the coal train. I think we're more concerned at this point about oil moving. We've had a 3 or 4-fold increase in the number of oil tankers moving through the state with shale oil from the upper mid, from Wyoming, or whatever you call that, upper Midwest, I don't know, the Bakken oil fields. And we're concerned about it, not just because it's a it's nasty stuff to burn, but we're also concerned about it because it has this problem where it blows up. It's much more explosive than normal light sweet crude. And so there's been a number of towns, one in Canada, I think one in Pennsylvania or New York, that where the trains derailed and caused immense explosions. So we did not come to an agreement with the Senate on restricting those, but I was able to get a study in the budget, so we'll actually know what's going on with those, and we're trying to build a policy to fix that so that we don't have the danger. All those trains run through downtown Seattle. you know, it's one thing if they're sort of rumbling through unpopulated parts of the state and they derail and blow up, like, okay. But, I mean, I'm sure it would be a bad thing, but having one blow up underneath downtown Seattle would be a very bad thing. So we're trying to get a handle on that, more about public safety than it is about energy policy. Then you want to move in, so your next sort of step down the triage ladder is, how do you get more renewables into the state? We're driving a lot of renewables. If you drive out to go see a concert at the Gorge or drive to Spokane, you'll see just these wind farms everywhere. And they're kind of cool sometimes in the light, but they're generating a lot of power. And we'll max out the power capacity of those ridges where there's big wind, which is the places where we can do that. There is some opportunity for solar. You talked about rooftop solar. And you can do tax credits for this. As I pointed out in my answer to Chuck, we don't really have a whole lot of money to give out a lot of money in tax credits right now. But one of the things that can make that kind of solar actually work is if you can finance it. It doesn't pay off in the short run. I mean, it might if you live in Arizona, but it doesn't here. But it does pay off in the long run. And if we can, and we've been trying to do this with the utilities, where we would allow a person to put the solar panels on the roof, and we would have public financing of it through the utilities, and then the payment for it would be added to your utility bill, which would stay with the house until the panels were paid off. And you would probably see a net reduction in your utility bill because it would drive down your utility rates. In order to do that, we need to have you be able to sell the power back and forth to the utility. And that's taken us a while to work through. We are working through trying to make that work. That's slow. And those are sort of the big efforts underway to try and get more renewables. There's a bunch of people experimenting with other stuff, tidal power, and I don't know that I see those things going anywhere big. I do think we will see more natural gas, which is, while it's not 100%, well, it's not renewable, it has much less impact on the environment than burning coal does, and is a good transitional step, particularly as we try and get more natural gas into the truck fleet. We're converting the ferry fleet to burn natural gas because it's cheaper than oil, and it has the ferries generate an immense amount of carbon in the air. And so if we can get them to burn natural gas, it'll be better and it'll make the ferries last longer. So there's a place where we're investing, and I think we're going to wind up with a natural gas import plant somewhere down in Pierce County. I don't know exactly where they're planning on putting it. So those would be my sort of steps that we're taking. The sort of high impact things that you could do that I don't see happening, at least with this Senate, would be a major tax change to either go to a carbon tax or go to a cap and trade system. The Senate seems sort of to consider that anathema, and I don't see them doing that, though it's worth talking about. I would not want to be the only state that did that. I would want to line up with the whole West and get the whole West to do it, because otherwise I think you're putting your manufacturing industries at a disadvantage to other states, and we'd want to do that as a group. But if we did that as a group, I think you could make it work. So that's where I am on that. Again, if people want to get questions in, they press *3, and that will get your question in the queue, and we'll try and answer all the questions that are in the queue. And if not, I'll get to them afterwards and call people back probably tomorrow, frankly.
All right. Thank you very much. We have around roughly 15 minutes left of this call. We've been doing great. Thank you for joining us and getting your questions in. Remember, press *3 on your keypad if you have a question. We're going with Karen, who has a question about Medicaid costs.
Hi, Ross. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about, with the increase in Medicaid enrollments inspired by Obamacare, mm-hmm. how do we as a state pay for that increase after the federal government quits subsidizing it?
The federal government doesn't quit subsidizing it.
That's not what I've heard.
Well,
that's not what I heard.
The plan is that the law, the federal law, all of the new people not all the new people, all of the newly eligible people who've come onto Medicaid are today paid 100% by the federal government. And that ramps down to about to 90% between now and 2020. So at that point, the state will be paying 10% of the cost of people between 138% of the federal poverty level and 200% of the federal poverty level, which are the newly eligible. Prior to us doing the Affordable Care Act, the state had a number of programs where we paid 100% of the cost. And the reason that there was no fuss about adopting the Affordable Care Act last year was that doing it saved money. It saved money in the short term, and it saved money in the long term. This is why the Republican Senate agreed to do the Medicaid expansion, because for us, we were able to step back from the basic health plan and transition all of those people either into Medicaid or into the exchange. Almost all of those people transitioned to become newly eligible Medicaid clients. And we saved about $300 million in the current budget period, the 2013 through 2015 budget. And our budget projections going out through 2020, having us save money through that whole time period, so we'll be net positive in 2020, and we get 300 and some thousand additional people get health care coverage. So that was the deal. Now, the concern that I've heard expressed is, oh, the federal government will stop paying for Medicaid. And this was a concern that was expressed in the 60s as well, when we sort of first 60s and 70s when we did Medicaid. And at the time, the federal government agreed to do a 50% match. And for 40 years, they have done a 50% match. The match has not gone down. Match varies around a little bit depending on the poverty rate of the state that you're in. We're not a high-poverty state, so we're right around 50. There are some very high-poverty states that get a higher match, but I would not want to become a higher poverty state in order to get a higher match on that. That would be a Pyrrhic victory. Unlike mutual funds, I think this is a case where past performance is an indicator of future results. Also, I will point out that there are a number of Republican governors who are doing Medicaid expansions in their state because they can do the same math that we did. Senator Hill and I looked at each other, and we're looking at the numbers, and we had some disagreements about specific things that we were doing as we adopted the Medicaid expansion, but he and I both said, look, this just pencils. This makes sense for the state to do financially, and he's got a lot of people in his caucus who are concerned that the federal government will welch on it. All those governors, they all call their senators, and I can't see that happening. I mean, this is one of those things where politically it would be very, very hard for Congress to step back from that. And if they did, as part of our expansion, we put language in that said if they step back, we could cancel the expansion. So we would not be on the hook to pay for it if the federal government doesn't live up to their responsibility to pay for it. So saved money, covered hundreds of thousands of more people, and I'm personally not super concerned about the feds welching because they haven't welched on it so far.
Okay. Thank you. We have about 10 minutes left of this call, so I think we can take a couple more questions before we do closing remarks. If you have a question, though, be sure to press *3 on your keypad right now. We're going with Bill, who has a question about the annual financial report. Bill?
Yes. Ross, I was wondering, there was some comment a little while ago about ownership of assets and so forth. Who owns the assets identified in the comprehensive annual financial report for the state of Washington? And do you know what the value of that would be at this time?
This is the CAFRs. We have a lot of assets. I have no idea what the total value is. I mean, you add up all of the University of Washington, you add up the Metropolitan Tract, every state-owned building all over the state. Then you start looking at the highway system. And you say, well, maybe do we own the state highways? Yeah. Do we own the federal highways? Nah, maybe not. We pay for a lot of the repairs. I don't know.
I was thinking more in terms of the investments in Wall Street.
Oh, the
globally.
Oh, okay. More specific question about what is our investments through the State Investment Board?
The state investment, yes, that number I think is somewhere north of $70 billion, and
yes,
I'm just wondering who owns that and why isn't that the gains in that program utilized to handle what all these tendencies to want to increase taxes when there's enough there to probably eliminate the property tax if we're properly invested and considered something for the public use rather than who owns it and where's it going to go?
Okay. Well, the reason that we have the State Investment Board is because we, like every other state, have a pension system. And people make pension contributions into the system. Both individual employees make contributions, and the state essentially matches their contribution. And those contributions get invested, and we use the returns from that investment to pay for the pensions. So the state owns the money that's in the thing, but all of it is spoken for to pay for the pension obligations that we have. So we can't go spend it. If we went and spent it, we would be doing what Chicago and Illinois are doing, or California, or Detroit. Detroit's a great example where they did not make investments at the time people were employed. They gave away free pension benefits. They have a very, very rich pension system, much richer than ours, and they didn't pay for it. And so now the bill is coming due, and the city has shrunk by two-thirds of what it was when they made all those promises, so they don't have a chance in hell of paying that off. And so the responsible thing for a state to do, just like for a company that has a pension system, just Boeing does the same thing. They have a big pension system. They have a big lot of money that they have invested, and the investments for that go to pay off the pensions as people retire. So that's why we invest the money. We don't have more money than we need to fund those pensions. Depends on the year, but we're at about 95% of having money in the system to pay for all those obligations. And I, for one, think that that's the responsible thing for us to do. The courts would probably have something to say if we tried to spend that money on current obligations, but it would be, at that point, it would be like, taking out a mortgage on your house to buy groceries. That's a long-term asset because we have long-term liabilities, and they balance each other out on the balance sheet. So you have a long-term liability, and you have an asset that has an actuarial value that enables you to pay for that. And balancing that is hard, and has been one of the most interesting things that I have learned that I would have never thought I would become interested in is pension policy. But that's why we have $70 billion in the bank. We had 40 when I started because we had this huge crash when the stock market crashed in 2000. And we've been building those assets back. Over the last 10 years, we returned 8.3% on our investments over the last decade. Which is a little bit more than we had predicted that we would do. So
That's
why.
Thank you. We have 5 minutes left of this call, so I think we have time for just one more question. However, if you have a question, be sure to press *3 now. We still have staff on the line, so you can get your question in. We're going with Jane, who has a question on fracking.
Hi, I'm Jane, and I'm in Bellevue. And I'm very concerned about fracking in that it takes more energy to create a barrel of oil or natural gas than you produce. And the second concern is that the water usage for fracking is abominable. Anyhow, I'd like to know what our policy is in this state about fracking. Okay. Is it going to be allowed?
An answer to your question is, wow, I don't know. It's never come up because we don't have deposits of oil or natural gas in Washington that we would, that anyone wants to go mine. So we just don't have, no one's doing it. I have no idea what the policy was. It would probably make some sense to have a policy in place prior to someone discovering, I can see Jed Clampett, you know, discovering oil or something out in eastern Washington. But it just isn't an issue in Washington because we don't have any either oil or natural gas anywhere close to the surface that anyone has ever tried to drill for. So I'll go look into it. I think it would be interesting to know. We did look at one point a couple years ago about what would we – did we have a mineral extraction tax policy? We have a couple of very small mines in Washington State, and there was some thought that there might be new mines and we might want to have a policy in place so that we would be like Wyoming or Colorado or other places that have a lot of mining. There are some taxes on that that are hard to put in place once there's someone doing it, but perhaps would make more sense prior to such a thing occurring. But to my memory, that did not go anywhere, but there's not a lot of economic activity in that area. So I think that is the end of the time we have for actual questions, and I'm betting my moderator wants me to make closing remarks now. Is that right?
That is correct, Ross. Thank you. And folks, please remember, if your question did not get answered, please leave a message after the call.
Yes, and I will go and capture all of those questions, and I'll call people back and let you know what my answer is, and I'll try and get the answers on my website on rosshunter.info so that people can, you know, see what the questions are and what the answers are. I think this is really a fun thing to do. We get more questions here than when we do this live. And it's just me, so I don't have to compete with Senator Tom or Representative Habib, who's much more aspirational. I'm wonkier, but he's a much more aspirational speaker than I am. So I don't like competing with him. So I like doing these. I don't want to just do these because I think it's important for people to see us stand there and just take whatever questions come up. And there's always some risk, you know, there's a whole room full of people who are screening these questions, and I have no idea what criteria they're using. So these have all been interesting questions. I will try and answer all the questions. Thank you. We have work to do, would be my sort of key closing remarks. While I was sitting here on hold waiting for the call to start, I started making my agenda for the interim. I have a huge amount of work to do on McCleary. We did not make nearly as much progress this year as I would like to do on our core school funding responsibility. And we have both a challenge of defining exactly what that is, as well as a challenge of defining where does that come from. Senator Hill and I both have very different approaches on how to deal with this, and we are going to have to come to an agreement in the end, or I think the courts will force us to come to an agreement. And I also had a conversation today with Representative Cliburn. Judy represents the 41st District, just south of here, Mercer Island, Bellevue, Issaquah area, Renton, and she's the transportation chair. And that is a frustrated woman right now. She doesn't have anyone she can negotiate with. The Senate does not seem to have the votes to pass any transportation package. And she and I agreed that we would sit down in the interim and see if we could sketch out both a package that maybe we could get some agreement with the Senate on, and one that if we could not get agreement on a statewide package, was there something that we could do where just the Puget Sound would tax ourselves to do transportation improvements, because we see it as crucial to the growth of our economy. I also didn't really get a question on early learning, which I had hoped to do. I did a big policy bill this year, which did not pass because we did not have the money to fund it, and we're going to come back to that next year, which is how do we fund early learning for at-risk kids? How do we make sure that the quality of the early learning opportunities that we are currently providing to about 50,000 low-income kids in Washington, we have to make sure that that's a high-quality system, and I will be back with the Early Start Act hoping to get that done. and I think I am done. I just got handed a note that says I have less than 1 minute.
Indeed. So, hey,
indeed.
Thank you very
thank
much,
you
everybody. Thanks for joining us, and see you next time.